problem here, why this war is going so slow, is they're Russians. They may not want to comprehend that they're Russian, but they are Russians. They're ethnically, genetically Russians. We're all the same people. It's the Soviets that broke this up. It was a Soviet project to make a separate Ukraine and Ukrainize the Russian population and make a separate Belarus, divide and rule. And Russians are extremely stubborn. They don't like to surrender. We don't like particularly to even step back. And that's the problem is, you know, if you throw in the Germans, and Germans are not bad soldiers, but you throw in the Europeans, they're going to have a hell of a time because it's a different mentality. Russians fight to the end just out of spite. And this is what we're doing. We're fighting our own people. So in Russia, it's viewed as a civil war. We're fighting our own people. And this is why it's taken so long. One, we're trying to do minimal damage because it's our own people. Two, it's just, you know, they'll stand there to the end just because. Even if they didn't ever want to fight, they get tossed in there, they get press ganged off the street, and a lot of them will just stand there just because it's just stubbornness. It's ingrained Russian stubbornness. So that's why it takes a long time. But they're breaking anyways at this point because they're out of food, they're out of ammunition. The Russian army is not going to charge into Mirograd. They've surrounded Mirograd. Pokrovsk has fallen. Pokrovsk is totally fallen. Mirograd is like 10-15%, but it's all surrounded. There's no point in trading men for men. It's a lot cheaper to trade artillery and drones for men. You just sit back. They're not going anywhere at this point. The Ukrainian counterattacks are pointless. They're just losing men and equipment. They don't have enough heavy equipment to throw in it, and the men they have are worn out. So they're just doing these PR attacks. I mean, it's costing them men. They're losing a couple hundred guys in these pointless counterattacks. But Zelensky needs to show that the Ukrainian army can still do something. He keeps throwing these men into these pointless death charges. They're not moving the Russian lines in any direction. The Russian lines, before they closed in, they dug in well. And you always keep a corridor out for the enemy to psychologically that they think they can still retreat. Because if you fully surround them, you know, then it's standard, and it's surrender or stand and die. It's one or two choices. But as long as there's a corridor, there's always that psychological, maybe I can make it out. You know, a gambler, certainly. I mean, if we break, maybe we can get out. But Mirograd,
in fact, on that point, so you mentioned the counterattacks that have been going on. We see especially that around Rodinska, where either the Ukraine side is trying to break out so that the folks that are trapped in Mirograd can get out, or that they're just fighting the Russians around there to get more men in. Do you have any sense of which one of those two things is going on?
I think they're trying to get out. As always, you know, Ukraine has this great, each army in the world has its own traditions. Ukraine, since 2014, has a tradition of getting themselves surrounded. They can break in, or they stay in too long, and they get surrounded, and they get wiped out. So it's right now it's trying to break out. It's trying to open a corridor to break out. And
so would they do that, though, if they were able to break through at Rodinska? Would those guys who were in Rodinska, who are in Mirnograd, would they exit?
Well, they would try to exit. Look, you know, exiting is... it's near impossible. I mean, right now there is actually a corridor. It's about a kilometer wide, but your chances of getting out of there are slim to none. No vehicles will ever get out because all the roads are covered. You can't get off the roads because if you've never been in that mud, oh, geez. You ever been to Hohenfels?
I have. Spent a lot of time there.
Yeah. That mud is like a little – that mud is nothing. That mud is absolutely nothing compared to this mud. Black earth mud, it'll suck the socks off of you. It may suck the skin off of you. I mean, you're walking, you're just pulling up kilos and kilos of extra weight under you because of the mud. The heavy U.S. equipment and Western equipment, it just sits in that mud and that's it. It's not going anywhere. I watched a video where they had a Max Pro get stuck in that mud. They had three tractors and they couldn't pull that Max Pro out. Big civilian farm tractors. And it's not going anywhere. It just sucks in, and it's like cement, except it's still liquid. You're not going anywhere. So the vehicles are gone. You're not going to take any heavy equipment, and they're just running. But they're running across open fields. There's no places to hide. The area is swept by direct fire weapon systems, everything from our field artillery to on a direct fire mode to heavy machine guns, drones, FOBs from aviation, helicopter gunships that'll pop up on the edge and just fire off. I mean, you name it, and the tanks are in the hull down position. It's a death valley. So there's no chance. I mean, maybe twosies or threesies, some will get through, but the vast majority are going to be there for until their bodies are picked up.
And so, by the way, just kind of throw this out there just for people's understanding. When I was in the 1st Squadron, 1st Cavalry, actually spent time, this is at Grafenwehr, and I do have some idea what some of that mud is like. This is one of our field exercises where we would add a little bit. So I'm guessing you're talking something like this.
No, much, much worse. That's brown mud.
Much worse. Okay. Stuff.
At this point, if the mud was that worked up, that truck or that trailer would be hauled down.
Oh, my.
Black mud. Viscous black mud. I mean, you stick a stick into that mud, and it'll grow you a tree. It will grow. Black soil is the best soil you can ever get. Anything and everything will grow in it. It is hyper fertile. And when it turns to mud, I mean, World War II, both sides would stop and wait, because until the mud drains off in the spring when the snow melts or the mud freezes, you know, the German offensive on Moscow started after November when the ground froze. Yeah, the Germans had to literally pickaxe their tanks out of the ground to get them going again. But that's when it started. When that mud comes, it's over. Infantry can still move.
This muddy season is really just beginning. We haven't got to the frozen season yet, as you just pointed out there. So then the question comes in, when it does freeze over, what is going to be the possibility that we finally see some of these larger Russian assaults that are combined to arms operations on a larger scale? Or is that something they're still just thinking about?
They're still thinking about it. I think there's a good possibility. The problem is, you know, the climate has gotten warmer. And, you know, I'm just outside of Moscow. It's the 12th of December. It's plus 6 outside and raining. We're going to have the first freeze at night on Monday. About minus 4, and it'll be plus during the day. Normally, by mid-November, you've got a snow cover. At least historically, by mid-November, you had already a serious snow cover. It's raining, and this is here, down south. I mean, this is southern areas, Lugansk and that area, and Donetsk, northern Donetsk, they're warmer. They're much warmer than here. It's 4 or 5 degrees warmer. I mean, you get closer to Black Sea, it gets to temperatures like South Carolina, North Carolina, that type of temperatures. And even the further you go toward like Eastern Black Sea, you're hitting Georgia temperatures. So it rarely ever freezes. You get once in a while. But in that area, I mean, if it's plus 6 here today, and we're barely getting into an actual, what kind of looks like a beginning of winter, it'll be another month there. And then the question is, will it though? Again, 2022, 24th of December, and it was mud and green grass when we went down there. Even though it was heavy snow in Moscow, probably about 0.5 foot of snow cover, and you get down there and it's all green grass. So it's very hard to tell. And the winters are getting warmer, so it becomes much harder to do heavy equipment because the water is evaporating. It runs off to a certain degree, but it's not evaporating because there's no heat, but it's not freezing either. So you get this quagmire that it used to last for a month and a half, and now you're getting a quagmire that's lasting for 3 months. I mean, last winter, 22 days in January in Moscow were above freezing. We had no snow. All the snow melted off.
Yeah. So now I want to talk to you. Yeah, one of the potential consequences of the Russians not choosing to or not being able to operate with these large scale assaults, which could literally break the front lines and possibly even roll up the defenses, which could end it pretty quickly if they were successful. The fact that they're not doing that allows the other side to believe that it's never going to happen. In fact, I want to go somewhere in just a second, but before I get there, let me ask you one more question, because this is something that's on the minds of many in the West, is that they believe that Russia has gone on this slow grinding pace that's methodical, but it's still quite slow in terms of how much territory, because that's all they can do. Do you believe that?
No, absolutely not. Russia is conserving manpower. The kill ratio right now is hitting about 10, 11 to 1. And it's going to get worse because the Ukrainian side is out of experienced men, and they're just throwing in whatever they can grab to hold whatever or do whatever counteroffensive they can think of at the moment. Like I said, most of these little counterattacks are absolutely pointless. So it's getting worse and worse for their side. Obviously, for various reasons. One, I mean, the Russian army, there's another 300,000 men outside of Ukraine that are being rotated in. Their brigades are doing rotations, right? So they're coming in for 6 months, and they're rotating back out for R&R. Next brigade comes in for 6 months on the front line, and they're getting combat experience, and they're rotating through brigades and battalions. Ukraine is just, once you get their front lines, you're there till you die, or you run away. Or you get wounded enough. I mean, you're looking at 1.8 million killed between Ukrainian soldiers and Mercs. A lot of NATO, we're fighting NATO. Let's begin with that. NATO is already there, unofficially, but there. The Poles have taken around 10,000 casualties. I said, when I was there, down there the first time, there are Polish regular units. They're quote Mercs, right? But, you know, when you have whole battalions that are suddenly quitting, I mean, you know. And I'm talking to guys, and like, yeah, they're all in the same uniforms, they all have the same patches. You know, it's obvious it's one unit. It's not a bunch of people that came in there mismatched and they all got tossed into it. Now there's mercenary companies there too. I mean, really mercenary companies. So it's a whole hodgepodge of different things. There are 2,000 Finns that suddenly quit the Finnish military and disappeared. Yeah, they disappeared. They went down to fight. They got sent down there. They get these rotations, combat experience. This is, by the way, one of the reasons Macron is so prone to try to get into Ukraine is he needs to explain why there's hundreds of dead Frenchmen up and down the front line. He can't. And it's bubbled up a couple times in French politics, and it's been a big argument all over that. But he's tampered it down. But if he can get the French army, even the Foreign Legion in there, they'll take massive casualties, and you can just kind of shove the other casualties underneath those lines. And that's the type of politicians we're dealing with in these Western European countries. So Russia is going, as Colonel McGregor said very correctly, it's a big vacuum. Basically, the Russian, your advancements are, why those guys, by the way, on those pit bikes, advancements are very small groups. They'll take a small position, hold it. The next group comes up, takes the next small position. You don't have big concentrations of men because of high explosive, because you're out in the open, particularly Ukrainians won't, because we've got domination and fobs. And if you put a battalion, you put a platoon together or even a squad, yeah, they'll probably get a fob, at least a 250 kilo fob. But if it's a platoon level, they'll bring a 1,500 kilo fob or 3,000 kilo fob, and there's going to be nobody left alive. There'll just be a gigantic crater. Amongst other things. So there's no point in bringing large amounts of troops in. Drones also limit how fast which you can move. But on these pit bikes, what they can do is they'll pop in and they're going full speed, two or three pit bikes with two guys on them. Artillery can't adjust fast enough. By the time they realize they're coming in, you're talking about two, maybe a kilometer and a half, 2 kilometers they need to cover to hit that the first line of defenses. By the time they realize what's happening, most of the time they can't even get the drones up fast enough before these guys are already on top of whatever position, flushing out and taking out the position. And then they entrench into that position, hold, get hit by drones, of course, and then the next group comes in. And that's just how you're moving forward. I mean, it's totally different from what you and I were trained to do and what the Russian military was trained to do, because everybody was trained for these big maneuvers, battalion, brigade, division, corps level maneuvers. It's all changed. Unless you want to take a lot of casualties. Now that the Ukrainian line's thinned out enough from attrition warfare, now you can actually start, even with the modern technology that's out there, you can start moving into larger armored fists, because there's not enough drone operators, drones, and everything else to stop you.
Yeah, there's been
especially if you do a big breakthrough.
Yeah, there's been lots of reports here in just the last week or so that there are sections of the line where Russian soldiers have been seen moving out in the open because there aren't enough Ukrainian drone operators. And the Russian has counter drone operators themselves, whose only mission is to find the Ukrainian drone operators, because once you knock those out, then it opens up stuff for the troops on the ground. Have you seen evidence of that?
Absolutely. And you know, the anti-drone technology is also growing. I mean, drones have full combat dominance for a while, and they're already starting to lose that. It's the usual offense-defense race. You know, at one point, tanks were unstoppable. All of a sudden, things came out that stopped tanks very well. It didn't mean tanks went away. It just meant that things got more complicated. So there's Chinese laser systems, which are very good. They've been field tested in Russia. They, for a quadruped, for a quadra drone, less than a second before it cuts right through it. For an airplane style drone, it takes, I think, about like 6 seconds before it's burning. Unfortunately, lasers don't work in fog, and they don't work in very bad conditions. They don't work in rain because of the raindrops right. will dissipate the laser beam. You got anti-drone drones, shotguns. I mean, you got the whole range of equipment. And the best thing you can do is just destroy the drone operators. And there are systems that will find where the drone operators put in the signal. It's much harder to do with fiber optic drones, obviously.
Yeah.
Right. Drones have their own limits, though. They're not as fast. They're not as maneuverable. They give you a great image. And sometimes you can actually find out if the field isn't totally covered. You can kind of find out where they're shooting from, the drones, because the fiber optic cable is laying on the grass. And if you pull on it, especially if the sunlight's just right, the light will bounce off of it. So you kind of tell which direction they're flying from, especially if they're close enough. So you get these reconnaissance and sabotage teams out there, and sometimes they can find where the drone operators are located by the fiber optics cable and then call in artillery on them.
Okay.
It's more of an exception than rule, but there's that.
That's what they can do. Right. I get it. Yeah. I want to shift gears here because we're running low on time. I don't want to let you get away before we ask a couple of different things. One is that because of the delay and the slow speed, which the perception in the West is that whatever the reality is, the perception is that Russia's going this slow because that's all they can do. They can't go any faster. So we're kind of safe here. So we can dink around with some other things, and we can actually try different things here, and we have the freedom to do that. One of them, and this was a video here by a guy named John Sweet, who is a defense contractor and an analyst. He has a rather unique explanation or idea for what the West should do now as we enter the 4 year mark of the war.
Saturday evening, he fired 458 drones, 45 missiles, and 32 ballistic missiles at Ukraine, both at those power stations that you make reference to, but also civilian targets in their urban homes. Ukraine right now destroyed, at least according to the Ministry of Defense, they were able to destroy 89% of those drones, but only 20% of the ballistic missiles. 20%, that means 80% of those missiles had their desired effect, that they hit the targets that they were going after. So once again, we're going back to NATO and saying you have to implement a no-fly zone in order to protect Ukraine. You have to. If you don't do that, he's going to continue to exploit what he considers to be a vulnerability. And the vulnerability is to missiles, cruise missiles and ballistic missiles. Now, the answer is to stop those missiles, one, from being fired, so attacking the source, which is the launch systems, whether it be a Tu-95 or a MiG-31 or the actual missile launcher on the ground. That's part of the equation. The other part of the equation is the deep strikes, okay, with, if you will, storm shadows, ATACMs, and possibly Tomahawk missiles if the United States could ever get around to releasing them.
So what do you think about that claim there that what NATO, quote, has to do is to just implement a no-fly zone? I mean, that would solve all the problems. What would Russia do if NATO decides to implement a no-fly zone in Ukraine?
I'm sorry, this guy's an idiot. Oh, my God, this guy is so whacked in the head. He's an idiot. Don't let him anywhere near anybody make a decision.
He's wearing a suit. He gets paid a lot of money.
God, you know, I've been listening to the various U.S. And British and German generals and all these other people. I hope they're making a lot of money because they really got this death wish. Let's begin with, first of all, ATACMS aren't long-range missiles. They're medium theater-level missiles. Why ATACMS aren't particularly used. Now, New York Times has stated it was U.S. generals that requested ATACMS, and they're planning the missions. And I was saying that before, that HIMARS are, those are maybe Mercs, or through some company, but those are Americans and Brits. They're not Ukrainians. And I'll tell you one particular reason why. Because not a single HIMAR has been bought by Russia. Think of what I'm saying. The way this works is Russia's bought every piece of equipment that the West has thrown in there. And the way it works is you contact the guys on the other side. You tell them, look, this is how much we're willing to pay for this equipment. They go, okay. And as they're moving away, they bury that piece of equipment. And they send over the coordinates. The money goes into their account, and they mark it off as lost in combat. And everything has been bought, at least one working
bomb. Wait. You're telling me that Russia has coordinated with somebody on the Ukraine side to purchase some of this equipment, and then they make a deal where they'll bury it, run away, and then the Russians come and uncover it?
Absolutely. It's been since day one. I mean, these guys, you got to understand.
That's kind of new information. I hadn't heard that one before.
Yeah, I know. I've never been reported, which is funny. That never gets reported. I mean, this was, by the way, being done since 2014. Guys were buying equipment from the Ukrainian army, the rebels in the east. But it accelerates. So all this new equipment coming in, Abrams tanks haven't been sold. But a lot of this equipment, it gets buried as they're being pushed back, and then they get money. There's contacts going on, particularly there's contacts. Wow. A lot of people know each other, particularly senior officers, they know each other. A lot of them served together in the Soviet Union. It's only 30 years ago, or they're relatives. I mean, but God's sakes, I mean, even Sirsky. Sirsky was born in Russia. His family lives in Russia. Nobody touches his family because we don't do those kinds of things. Ukrainians do those kinds of things. We don't do those kinds of things. His father just got out of the hospital for heart surgery, government paid for it. This is the reality of it. And these field commanders, they're getting paid. A lot of them are making money. There's so many corrupt ways to make money. One of them is they're forcing, one of the reasons there's 400,000 missing in action, because they're being dumped, their bodies are being dumped, is they don't want to admit they're dead because they continue drawing some kind of salary. And that goes on to that brigade commander's or battalion commander's, credit card or debit card. His bank account. So he's pulling them out of that. As long as they're, quote, missing in action, they're still maybe in combat. So they're still drawing a salary. As opposed to if they're dead, they're dead. That's it. Oh, there's massive amount of corruption in every single direction. In there.
So now tell me, what does Russia do with these weapon systems once they purchase them and uncover them? What do they do with them?
Well, what would the U.S. do with them? You take them back, you split them, you take them apart. Reverse engineer them, see what's good, see what's bad, see what you can improve on your equipment. Same thing the U.S. does, same thing every country does. You get somebody's piece of equipment, you reverse engineer it. Let's see what makes it tick, what's good about it. Everybody does that.
Is that one of the reasons why the HIMARS and the ATACMS progressively are less effective in Russia, because they figured out a way to defeat them because they have some of these?
No, HIMARS they don't. That's an interesting thing. Nobody's ever sold a HIMAR. And there's no contacts with any Ukrainians on those HIMARS. Those are Mercs in there or some company. And they're not Ukrainians. So every time a HIMAR goes up, somebody, either Americans are getting killed or Europeans are getting killed. By the way, Patriot systems, a full Patriot battery is 94 people. Now, look up how long it takes to train a mechanic for a Patriot system. It's 54 weeks. Officers in the Patriot systems are half a year training. Now you figure out how many Patriot systems have been destroyed, and you've got to figure out how many Ukrainians did they actually train on Patriots, because they've only started training them after conflict started. So very quickly start to figure out those aren't Ukrainians sitting on those Patriots. They're either Americans, Brits, Germans, Poles, somebody. So when that Patriot sucks in a Kinjal or sucks in an Iskandar system, those aren't Ukrainians burning up in that. Oh, nobody wants to talk about that. That's a different thing. There's been plenty of Americans. There's been plenty of Brits have been killed along the way. You know, maybe they're paying the families off to shut up. Because I doubt all of them were Mercs. Some of them were Mercs, obviously.
I'm running short on time. I wanted to ask you, what would the Russians do if John Sweet here, what he recommended was actually enacted, and they put in a no-fly zone against Russian assets in Ukraine? What would Russia do?
It wouldn't be a no-fly zone. It would be air combat for air dominance. you would have S-400s, S-500s, S-300s taking out American planes. American planes would be taking out Russian planes. Russian planes would be taking out American planes. You'd have full combat. You'd basically have World War III. It would be instantaneous. I mean, that's
Russia
beyond a doubt.
Back off is what you're saying.
No, hell no. Okay, for Russia, this is existential. We back off, we die as a country. If it goes to nuclear war, then to hell with it, we'll go to nuclear war. That's the point. U.S. can back off. NATO can back off. Russia cannot back off. This is the same thing as if, you know, if the Soviet Union was in Mexico invading into Texas. U.S. isn't going to back up. This is we'll go to nuclear war before we give up any territory or move out from defending our border. It's the same thing. This is an existential crisis. When a country gets an existential crisis and a nuclear power at that, you really don't want to go down that road, because the next option is nuclear strikes. If it goes down to the point we're losing a war, that war, that means we're going to lose our country, we're going to lose our people. No, that'll go very quickly into escalation, into full escalation. Now, if they try to close the skies over Ukraine, that'll be direct conflict with the Russian Air Force and the Russian anti-air systems. And the Russian S-500s, just so you can understand, they'll pick up anything moving out of Germany. They may not be able to strike it out of Germany, but it'll be on the radar being tracked. And by the time it's in mid-Poland, it's going to get a missile for a hello from an anti-air missile. So that's the reality of it. If it's a Tomahawk, well, the problem with the Tomahawk is, what's the warhead? Is it a high explosive warhead? Is a cluster munition warhead, or is it a nuclear warhead? Well, how the hell do you tell on a radar? All you know is there's a missile coming, and it's a Tomahawk missile. Russia's nuclear doctrine: if there's a missile coming at Russia, or Moscow particularly, that could be a nuclear missile, is full broadside. It's not going to be a one-for-one tick-for-talk. The nuclear doctrine is full release. So that you can very easily escalate to a full nuclear war instantly, just about instantly. So that's not a good idea. And Moscow can't take that risk. Nobody will take it. It's like a missile heading toward, Russia launches Zircon missile from toward Washington. Yeah, sure, Zircon missile is high explosive, but it can also carry a tactical nuclear warhead, 75 kilotons. Is Washington going to wait and find out till it blows up? Hell no. It's going to launch everything it has. It's instant nuclear war. This is the same thing. So these people are talking about this, they're idiots. They don't really realize what they're going down, what road they're going down to. And you cannot do a decapitation strike on Russia, because even if you do, the dead hand works.
Dead hand, yeah.
The dead hand, you know, it's got sensors everywhere in the major cities. It picks up high radiation spikes, earthquake-type tremors, and high temperatures, a nuclear strike. It has 20 minutes before it can be switched off by a human hand. It's not switched off by a human hand. It launches one ballistic missile, flies the length of Russia, giving out codes to all the missile carriers out there to launch, and coordinates to launch. So all the missiles are on trains, on boats, on roads, secret silos, submarines, everything gets a message, launch everything you have. And there's enough to, there was a study done for the U.S., and Russia's not much different. It takes 47 nuclear strikes to turn the U.S. into a medieval country. And you collapse technology-wise fully. You collapse the U.S. Russia's not much better. I mean, most modern nations are like that. They're actually very fragile. When you take out very certain points, certain cities, certain technology clusters, infrastructure clusters, that's it. It all collapses. You don't need to wipe out an entire country to destroy your enemy, in fact. So, people like that, when they start talking, just want to smack them upside the head with something very hard.
I'm right with you on that. I'll hold him down while you smack him, because that would be catastrophic for everyone. No one would win something like that, and I am adamantly opposed to any use of that. Well, listen, I can't tell you how much we appreciate you coming on today. Look forward to having you back. I wish we could keep on going here, but we're running out of time, but would love to have you back in the future and get some more questions asked.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll be the next couple of weeks, I'll be heading down again, so I'll have some more information, what I see.
Love to talk to you when you come back up. I want to hear what's happening back there, and be safe.
Thank you. God loves his fools, so...
All right. Well, thank you very much. And thank you guys for being with us today. As a reminder, we are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict. Let your friends know. A lot of those guys actually prefer to get their information on podcast or DanielDavisDeepDive.substack.com, where we have your information from the written and the video. One way or another, we are unintimidated and uncompromising. We want to make sure you get information so that you know what in the world is going on out there for real. Just like some of the stuff you heard today, you've never heard anywhere else. Let your friends know about it as well. Thanks, folks. We look forward to seeing you tomorrow on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.